Thank you.
Yes, thank you. Okay, well, my two co-authors really are Valerie Cardenas and Karina De Parker, who's actually from Waterloo and is now my postdoc. This, as you mentioned, this talk's a little bit different. I'm neither a mathematician nor a medic. I'm kind of an engineer, so this talk is not really describing modeling things. It's more describing some of the tools and the ideas behind trying to do some image processing, really, and study brain shape. The motivation for the work is neurodegeneration in aging and dementia. Particularly Alzheimer's disease plus many other dementias are associated with progressive neuron loss. And in the US alone, Alzheimer's affects around 4 million people. And apparently it costs over $100 billion a year, so I'm told. And with the increasing age of the population, the incidence rate will double in 20 years. So we need to find a way to diagnose Alzheimer's disease. No one really understands it at the moment, but we need to a way of trying to diagnose it, to quantify the progression of a disease, and also quantify the influence of any treatments. Neuron loss occurs in these types of diseases, and particularly the primary clinical marker at the moment for a diagnosis is cognitive and neurological testing. So people undergo tests for memory and certain reading or other basic cognitive abilities. And the problem with these, however, is that these cognitive tests have a very high level of error, and they're not very good when used multiple times, because people learn how to do them. And so we really need a more quantitative measure or description of what's going on in these subjects. And the idea is to try and use brain structure as some kind of surrogate marker for dementia. And the idea behind this is that if we're using neurons, which is the basic thing we're interested in, and then the apparent tissue volume, when you look at an MRI scan of a subject, if the neuron density is preserved somehow, should reduce. And in fact, this is to a certain extent true. And clinical radiology already uses structural MRI to provide a visual marker of dementia. And so we can use, there's some evidence that we can use just tissue volume as a surrogate marker for neuron loss. But what we want to do in this work is to try and provide a more sort of quantitative description of what's going on. The context of this work is really a little bit different from a number of the other talks, in that I work in a large lab that studies neurodegeneration using quite large-scale clinical imaging studies. So we get hundreds and hundreds of subjects being scanned repeatedly over many years and tracked, and also cognitively tested. And so we're acquiring large amounts of imaging data. And we're interested in basically what parts of the brain are most consistently affected by degenerative disease, or what characterizes particular diseases. These are example slices through 3D MRIs. So these are transaxial slices, and these are sagittal slices this way. And some of these, you can see the kind of range of anatomy we have. Some of these subjects look pretty ill, pretty abnormal, but in fact, this guy at the end is actually a control. He's perfectly fine cognitively. Some of these other subjects are actually have a disease. So the problem is to try and come up with descriptions that can differentiate between different types of tissue loss. So the general area of this work is what's called computational anatomy. So we're trying to apply mathematics or computing to study anatomy, which is it's quite a challenge in that most anatomy is generally in a clinical setting is described by sort of a clinical verbal description, and we're trying to put some more quantitative or statistical approaches to the problem. There are many aspects or approaches to measuring what's going on in the brain structure, and it covers a large number of areas: image processing, low-level image processing, tissue segmentation, surface or region extraction from MRI images and statistics for shape analysis. What I'm going to talk about is one part of that, which is called whole brain 3D deformation morphometry. And it has three components, really. Image registration, a bit of differential geometry to try and come up with measures of, that we're interested in terms of shape, and some spatial statistics. This is a really hard approach to take, but it's perhaps the most difficult, but also perhaps promises the most complete description of what's going on in the brain. So morphometry has quite a long history. Some of the famous early work is by Darcy Thompson, but a lot of this work, particularly started with this book, was based on picking landmarks in skulls, particularly, but on different types of anatomy or different objects, trying to characterize shape using 3D landmarks or 2D landmarks, and having, in particular, these are homologous landmarks, so we have, this allows us to have a define a distance between point pairs in different examples of shapes. Now, there's quite a long history of statistics developing ways of approaching, looking at what properties of shape that people are interested in, particularly looking at 1D data and psychometric data analysis. One of the interesting steps that is now used quite a lot is what's called precocity shape analysis. And the idea for this is, or the important thing this introduced, was that you could separate the effects of the orientation and location of an object from residual shape differences over the data. However, when you try and apply that to 3D MRI data, you run into some problems. Particularly, what we're interested in is looking for very local effects, particularly on very complicated 3D anatomy. And if we want to do that with landmarks, we need to pick many points in 3D. This is, in fact, quite difficult, either automatically or manually, to do. The other problem is that the landmarks or the things you're looking for are actually influenced by disease as well. So the definition of the landmark might change. So what we're doing is taking a slightly different approach to look at what's called, well, using volume or image registration to estimate transformations between images directly. This is particularly motivated by a number of recent improvements in image registration. And these provide fully automated estimates of how you deform one MRI image into another. Now, if you're thinking about how do we then use that to study shape, well, in the first case, we had homologous landmarks. So we have one point corresponds to another. And if we have instead two anatomies, which are a continuous space and a transformation between them, then we can think of the equivalent of this as having a homeomorphism. So we have two continuous spaces, and we have a transformation, which is one-to-one. We have an inverse for it. And this allows us sort of, you can think of this as the equivalent of having corresponding homologous landmarks. Secondly, if we take this a little bit further and say that the transformation is differentiable in some way, then we can use, we get a diffeomorphism. And the nice thing about this is then we can start looking at the differentials of these spatial transformations between anatomies. In particular, obviously the first derivative gives us estimates of the volume change induced between one anatomy and another. Or, in this case, it's giving us an estimate of the relative local anatomical size of this bit of anatomy compared to this. And this is quite nice because it matches what we're interested in terms of atrophy and volume loss. And this is what forms the basis of what was called deformation tensor morphometry, which has kind of evolved over the last 10 years, I guess, in medical imaging, along with the development of registration. So what we want to do is to basically take a reference anatomy and take our test anatomy and somehow deform use the reference anatomy as a ruler and work out how to deform that reference anatomy to match the test, and then look at the spatial derivatives of this deformation to give some indication of anatomical size. And in terms of engineering, there are a number of things we need to actually achieve this. We need some kind of registration algorithm, which consists of usually an image matching criteria, how well we've deformed one image to match another, plus some geometric model for how we do that or describe it. We also need some maths to describe how we're going to analyze these deformations across a population. Okay, well, one of the aspects where I came into this from my previous work in image registration is looking at the problem of trying to do registration of MRIs of older people. And particularly, if we're interested in using registration to capture shape in a scene of an older brain, for example, we're interested in the physical dimensions of things. And we're not interested in the fact that perhaps tissue has changed contrast or integrity. And we're interested in separating these two. And we know, unfortunately, that MRI tissue contrast does change both globally and locally in aging. So we've got a population of differently aged people, and we're going to get different things happening. This is a classic example here. This is white matter here is actually darker around the ventricles. This is called white matter signal hyperintensity because it's brighter, in fact, on a T2 MRI sequence. And this is a T1, it appears darker. There's other effects like lacunes that appear in older people. And on top of that, we're interested in the atrophy itself. The CSF around here is expanded, and the hippocampus has shrunk, for example. So if we were, for example, to try and match this with a target brain that didn't have these kinds of features, we'd have problems if we use conventional matching criteria. If you're deforming one image to another, conventionally you might use the sum of squares between the intensities of the image, or perhaps the correlation between the two images. And we can't do that directly because we end up with these regional differences and global differences in contrast. So we need a matching criteria that's somehow robust to these kinds of effects. So basically how I got into this a few days ago is because I'd worked on this problem in terms of MRI and CT and MRI and PET registration, where you've got medical images that have very different physical measurements and have very different contrasts. And in that field, there's a number of approaches been developed that use entropy and information theory to define measures of image registration. And essentially what we're trying to do with these kinds of approaches is taking two images and looking at their overlap with some sets of intensities. We're associating image values by their observed co-occurrence rather than their raw intensity value. We're not subtracting images. So we look at the probability within their overlap of different intensities occurring, and then the probability of co-occurring pairs of intensities in the two images. And this allows us to define various entropies, the marginal entropy and the joint entropy. And people have developed a range of information theory expressions to quantify give measures of image alignment. The one we're using is called normalized mutual information. And essentially when this is maximized, we're maximizing how one image optimally explains the intensities in the other image. And it allows, basically, because we're not directly subtracting the image values, it allows us some robustness to contrast change. Okay, the next component of the registration problem is how to describe the deformation. So we want to take an image and deform it non-rigidly to try and match another brain. For a lot of the results I'm going to show you, we're using what's called the freeform deformation, which is just a way of getting around. We don't want a parameter for the displacement of every single voxel. You know, we may have 10 million voxels in an MRI scan. So we want to step back and simplify it somehow. And we're using a B-spline to define or parameterize this deformation field. And simply the advantage of this is that it's controlled by a sparse set of control knots, which give, in this 1D case, we've got some estimate of the deformation at one point, is controlled by a set of neighboring control knots. via a set of polynomial basis functions. We're using cubic B-splines, which gives us a smoothly varying first derivative so we can estimate our volume changes. Because of this local support, we can come up with very efficient ways of refining and driving the registration, because we know these parameters only control deformations locally in space. In 3D, this extends, obviously, so we've got three 3D lattices of control knots over the image volume. And what we end up doing is that we've got these sets of lattices we then just simply maximize. We do an optimization of these control knot values to maximize the registration criteria, but penalized by a regularization that stops our deformation folding. Now, we need this because, obviously, in some regions of the image, you haven't got enough information to estimate the spatial transformation or corresponding features. You're estimating an image boundary, you get a good estimate of the displacement, for example, but in the middle of a piece of white matter, you don't know what the displacement is. We want to stop folds and tears happening in the deformation. We use a pretty simple multi-grid, multi-resolution optimization against these parameters. We start with a raw MRI scan and then match it directly to the brain. And then we refine down, so we start with a very coarse grid and then move down to a very fine lattice to capture very local changes in the brain, or differences in the two brains. this is just an example of actually doing that. We've got a reference anatomy here, and this is our subject, and this is having tried to deform this subject to this reference. And you can see we capture a lot of the anatomical differences. We've contracted the CSF space in the ventricle, we've expanded a lot of the white matter. And we've done pretty good in aligning a lot of the sulcal and gyral structures. Although we don't, that's the big problem with this, is there's no way you can map all the cortical structures perfectly. But this is kind of like the starting point for sort of a development. So with the first registration, then we use this to see what kind of results we can get. In fact, these results are pretty old, they're 3 years old now, I guess. So taking a step back, what we're doing is we've got this basic bit of machinery that takes two images and warps them. And what we're actually doing is looking at population. So we're taking all our population of aging and some of them with disease and warping these MRI scans to make them look pretty much the same. And then basically we throw away the intensity images and then look at the spatial deformations afterwards. Okay, well, going back to the deformation morphometry, we've got this. What we end up doing is evaluating for each individual this Jacobian of the transformation. And the simple way of looking at this, in fact, what I'm going to show you is that this obviously gives stretching in different axes and rotations. What we're doing is just, for a lot of this work, we've just taken the determinant of this to give a nice scalar summary of how big this bit of anatomy is here compared to here, for example. And you can visualize this. This is just simply seeing what's happening with it in terms of a grid. So a simple way of looking at it is just looking, coloring expansion and contraction as blue and red here. So what are we going to do? We've got loads of, we've taken our raw image data, and we've got to somehow analyze that in some meaningful way. Well, now we've thrown the intensities away, and we've got loads of the Jacobian or scalar value maps for each subject. And we know that local anatomical size varies due to many, many variables. Normal developmental variation, obviously, is a big factor. Age, gender, head size are obviously big effects on the size of a small region of anatomy compared to the whole head, for example. And what we're really interested in is disease effects. And so we need a way to decompose these for each point in the brain. So we're using techniques taken from fMRI data analysis, really, fMRI and PET analysis. So we're just using a very simple general linear model. So for a given bit of brain tissue, we have across a population of disease and controls, we have a scalar Jacobian values, and we, for each point then, we try to fit these with the information we have about our population. So we have a diagnosis, disease control, for example, age, which is a big effect on tissue volume. And this is basically integrating up our Jacobian values over our whole head. So this gives a measure of the relative size of the subject's head to the reference brain. So this is basically a model of the effects of local and global, the relationship between local and global head size. And this is obviously important because we know the hippocampus is bigger in people with larger heads. There are other effects you can use, for example, gender, but gender is still a little bit controversial in that it's actually highly correlated with head size. But some of these studies we've used that, some of them we haven't. Before we go on, I'll show you some results. I should tell you my standard warning about this. We're doing image registration. All we can do is match corresponding structures that are visible in the MRI images. So in atrophy, we can see tissue boundaries shifting, basically. But all we can do is infer the location of neighboring tissue loss. So for example, in this subject, you know there's probably some white matter missing, but we don't know exactly which bit of white matter corresponds in this subject. So there's a limit to what we're doing here. And what happens is that the contractions and expansions we're seeing are definitely going to be dependent on the model of the transformation and how we estimated it. However, we can still localize. You still get a localizing effect given the registration of other structures around a region. So that's my warning, but I'm going to go on and show you results anyway. So this is having done the fitting and everything across the population. We've taken 91 controls and 47 Alzheimer's subjects. And we've done this general linear model at every point in our reference brain. So we end up with a 3D volume of statistics. And in fact, what I'm displaying is the t-statistic of either the Alzheimer's diagnosis or the age effect in this volume. So this is, you can see basically the important thing you get out of this is that without any priors on the data, all we've done is thrown in raw MRI data. We see that the characteristic of Alzheimer's is contraction of the hippocampus, particularly around here, and bits of the temporal lobe, which is what we know from a lot of studies manually tracing. This is a good initial result. However, in aging, we also see the reverse effect that we've got pretty significant contractions in white matter and gray matter in the frontal lobe. You can turn this inside out and look at, this is just coloring, this is segmenting the ventricle structure and coloring the expansion effect of the ventricle inside. And you can see that both Alzheimer's and aging has an expansion effect. However, Alzheimer's is probably a greater effect, and particularly around the parietal lobe here, below the parietal lobe, I should say. And this is looking at the hippocampal and entorhinal cortex structure. So we've delineated what's going on in here, the hippocampus, and looked at the coloring. This is the coloring of the hippocampal surface with the underlying contraction we've seen that's fitted with this general linear model. So this is a very simple sort of example of what we're doing. What we really want to do is compare different dementias so we can see what's going on and diagnose different dementias. These are an examples of basically showing you can actually see these things happening in many of these MRI scans. So we're not mysteriously extracting things that aren't really visible. What we've got here is an Alzheimer's population. Alzheimer's is related to damage to episodic memory. Semantic dementia is more focused towards semantic memory loss, and you tend to see loss of tissue in the temporal lobe. Alzheimer's is kind of much more distributed across the brain, but generally parietal lobe. And there's another form of frontotemporal lobar dementia, which was related to semantic dementia, but has now been separated, and people are classifying this separately because it affects mainly the frontal lobe and causes personality disorders. And these two are very closely related still, because usually you get frontal lobe effects as well in some of these diseases. So when we do that, we run our general linear model across these three. These are quite old results as well. We see this is a fit of the contraction and expansion effect caused by Alzheimer's, somatic dementia, and FTD. We see a nice pattern of contraction of the temporal lobe in somatic dementia. This is expansion of CSF around the temporal lobe. The frontal variant, you see contraction of white matter and gray matter in the frontal lobe, which is nice. This is looking at the statistics with a sagittal slice. And see in Alzheimer's, you see the contraction of the parietal lobe coming down into the temporal lobe. And you see much more an effect of the frontal lobe again and the very focal temporal lobe in somatic dementia. And this is again turning it inside out and looking at the effect of the ventricle expansion. In Alzheimer's, in this set of Alzheimer's subjects, we're getting a very noticeable expansion effect in the ventricle below the parietal lobe. You see where the tissue is contracting, which you do not see in somatic dementia or the frontal variant, where the frontal variant is very frontally focused, that we're losing white matter around the ventricles. While in somatic dementia, we're losing both frontal lobe and temporal lobe. You see the CSF expanding in those regions. This is from a completely different study. This is looking at the effect of actually the interaction of heavy drinking and also HIV diagnosis and treatment. And this is just some, this is the effect of alcohol, very heavy drinking. These are some very early results again. We're looking at, we identify, we have a very large population, but we identified some white matter, patterns of white matter losses due to very heavy drinking. And this is in fact, is confirmed by manual tracing of the brain. This is the converse, the other half of the population. This is the HIV effect. We're looking at some losses of caudate and also the white matter in the frontal lobe. So these are looking at very large populations. And one of the problem with this technique, or things you have to consider, is we've got this degenerative process, whether it's Alzheimer's or heavy drinking or HIV, for example. And this process may act on random points within a broader region of anatomy. So a general diagnosis, all we're doing is separating Alzheimer's controls, for example, maybe a very coarse separation of what's going on. And we're not really, for example, we may get in Alzheimer's, we may get random points across some region, but our technique here is only going to identify those that are common across every subject. So we end up with, at a given scale, we don't see any effect. So one of the interesting ways around that is to look at much more sensitive functional differences across a population. So here we took our HIV alcohol population. We took some visuospatial executive function scores. And you see here that the better performance on this visuospatial task, I don't know what it was exactly, was related very focally to having more tissue, gray matter and white matter, in this bit of the cortex. And there's another task, conversely, this is looking at a failure on a processing speed test. I don't know what it was again. But you get a very focal correlation with contraction of white matter and gray matter as people performed more poorly on this test. So we're taking this huge population and we see some of them are very badly affected in a particular specific region. And this is in effect sort of like doing inverse fMRI. So instead of actually seeing people do a task and which bit of the brain is related to it, you're looking at a population and seeing who can't do a task very well and seeing which bit of the brain is missing in those subjects. Okay, so going back to this problem of scale, we'd also like to be able to analyze brain shape and this local anatomical size at a selectable scale. And the results I've shown you so far I've been looking at have used smooth Gaussian filtering to analyze the statistical effects. But the problem is with doing this is that we know that neighboring structures, for example, the layer of gray matter may contract, but CSF next door may expand, and we don't want to, when we're doing simple Gaussian filtering across these maps, we're going to mix up and confuse these different the behavior of these different structures when we're doing this shape analysis. So another aspect of what we've been doing is looking at different ways of filtering. So this is just a raw map of local anatomical size across the population. If we just blur it 3D and using a Gaussian, we lose a lot of structure. And we've been developing ways of using the underlying anatomy that we've registered to retain and use a more of a diffusion process to smooth the local size estimates, to pick a larger scale at which to look for shape differences. And we've done that. This is probably our best results at the moment. This is where we're looking at semantic dementia versus controls. And in using this, both with refined image processing and with the analysis at different scales, we were capable of looking at the effect in different kinds of tissues. So we're getting this nice map of contractions in gray matter compared to white matter in the temporal lobe. The interesting thing about this is that we're seeing this pattern around the temporal lobe, which seems to agree with some of the functional deficits in the semantic dementia. So we, around here in the superior temporal gyrus, we're getting quite a limited contraction effect, and it increases around into the entorhinal cortex and the hippocampus. And so the clinicians are very excited about this, because we're actually seeing which bits of gray matter and white matter are actually locally affected on a much finer scale. You're just looking at the same thing from the outside using a normal fusion rendering, so we're just coloring the surface with what's going on underneath. And again, you can see this definite focus of the disease towards the underside of the temporal lobe. And you get this asymmetry as well, which is very characteristic. You usually get one side, the left-hand side, is affected in semantic dementia. Now, all I've been talking about now is cross-sectional morphometry. So we've got a big study where we've taken one measurement from everybody in a population. And the problem with such a study is limited by the underlying normal variability of our subjects. And we're never going to get information about what the brain shape is of each individual as it's been evolved before the disease started, for example. The secondary problem is that particularly when you're looking at aging population, you've got aging as a cumulative random process. So you may start with disease and control populations with a very separate brain structure. But when you start adding the effects of disease, losing tissue cumulative randomly over time, these populations may get merged and get very difficult to distinguish between simple aging and an actual disease. The second problem really related with cross-sectional morphometry is that we can't really map one brain to another very, very accurately. We can do it pretty well, but we can't particularly get a lot of cortical areas registered very, very well. And so effectively we've got this imaging device that's giving us a map of local anatomical size, which is spatially varying. So some areas we have greater sensitivity than others. And we're never going to get better sensitivity in areas where we can't make our registration algorithm work. So the natural step to solve this is to look at shape change. And so in this case, we're taking multiple MRI scans of subjects. And the subject's first scan is used as their reference. And so there's no dramatic geometric or topological differences between the folding of the brain. And we can do a very accurate fine registration to capture a geometrical description of what's going on. However, the changes are very small, so we have to start considering image processing issues like imaging distortion, both geometric and in intensity. So essentially we've got a subject and they've changed somehow, but when we image them we get intensity distortion and we also get geometric distortion just induced by the scanner. This is just an example of removing some of the intensity distortion between two time points. You might actually be able to see the brightness of the MRI being removed. there. And what we're really interested in is all of this is distortion. When we remove that, we're interested in these little differences here, where the brain boundaries have shifted. So once we've done that, with these are just the two time points, these are rigidly registered. If we just subtract them, this is a subject with ALS, then we see the intensity differences that remain around the motor cortex, which is interesting. Then we run a very fine deformation algorithm that tries to capture this geometric description between these two to remove the intensity differences and get a geometric model of which bits have expanded and contracted. And this is just an image, again, of the Jacobian determinant. And what's nice about this is this is an ALS subject. So they've got a motor problems, an upper motor neuron, ALS. And the really nice thing is you're getting a very focal contraction. You're seeing as the disease has progressed between these two time points, you can actually see both the white and grey matter have contracted, and the volume has been lost from this subject, which is nicely correlated with how they're progressing. And hopefully we can use this then to measure whether particular drug treatments are actually improving the effect or removing the effect. This is just an example of doing the same thing with a subject with Alzheimer's disease and vascular dementia. This is two time points. And this is just a map of, you can see the very fine structure of bits of grey and white matter that are contracted in blue, and the CSF, which is expanding. You can see particularly the ventricle expanding and the white matter around it contracting. So these are just individuals. So what we want to do is analyze the data like we were doing cross-sectionally by taking individual maps, warping them to a common atlas or anatomical space, and then doing some analysis on what's common across this population. This is just an example of just, rather than doing statistics, we're just working out what the average atrophy rate is. So we've taken normal controls, and this is a map of the average atrophy rate, plus minus 6% a year. So we've got a reasonable rate of tissue loss in this quite old population. You see the ventricles expanding in particular, and white matter contracting around them. And this is Alzheimer's, so this scale is actually double. So we're getting more than double the rate of atrophy in around the ventricles, and you also see the cortical contraction. This is pretty early work from a couple of years ago. We've now taken some steps on from that, and one of the problems with this analysis is the kind of shown here. This is a subject with the frontotemporal variant of FTLD, which is the thing that affects the frontal lobe. And you can see here, particularly, what we've got is a subject, we've got two snapshots of where they are in their disease. And you can see already, this is the grey is the time point one, and then the colouring is the volume change to the next time point. You can see already they've lost more tissue on one side. It's a very asymmetric effect. And they're continuing to lose tissue on one side. And so what happens is you get a disease where we don't actually know we get a population of subjects with this things going on, and you don't know exactly how they're staged and which bit of the brain. There's obviously an order in these diseases in certain cases where certain sides of the brain or certain regions are affected first and then others. And very often we don't know in studying the brain shape exactly where each of these subjects are, so we're kind of throwing them together and averaging them. So what we want to do is try to build up a better model of what's going on in each subject to stage the disease when we do a kind of analysis of change. And this is one example of doing that. Even when you image normal controls, you see the brain shape changing, and the patterns are very, very different. And this is a go at looking at one covariate of normal aging, which is whether someone has a lacoon or a set of lacoons in their brain, which these are little vascular things in the white matter. A bit of blood vessel has burst and some tissue has died, and there's a little void in the middle of the white matter. And this has been related to increased loss of grey matter in the cortex. So this is an interesting covariate if we're looking at just normal aging. So what we did was we did this analysis of how the ventricles were expanding in time, in our population of Alzheimer's and normal controls. But then we split our group up into those controls that have lacunes and those controls that don't. So we have a map here of, the bottom map is the effect of the expansion rate or the pattern of expansion related to Alzheimer's disease. And the top row is, and that's compared to controls, and the top row is the effect of lacunes simply within the control group. And you can see that lacunes alone make your ventricle, particularly in the frontal lobe, expand more rapidly. But compared to the Alzheimer's, it's still pretty slow. But having said that, this is still an important covariate to put in there when you're comparing different groups. One of the problems with this analysis is that basically we've just got, for each subject, we have a record of whether they had a lacune or not, or more than one lacune. What we really need to do is trying to get a way of finding the lacunes and mapping their location so we can know that, you know, for example, this may be due to lacunes in the frontal lobe somewhere. Okay, so to summarize, we've been trying to use 3D volume registration techniques to automatically map brain shape, and particularly build models of the effects of disease to try to distinguish and diagnose the disease. In particular, we've used what's called deformation tensor morphometry, which allows us to separate local size from location when the brain shape is changing and aging. And we've used general linear modeling to try and spatially map the effect of changes in tissue volume over time and basically spatially localize these effects in the brain and relate them to cognitive changes. A lot of this work is very much developmental, and we've got improved registration methods and improved statistical analysis methods, but it's just a snapshot of where we are. And acknowledgements, obviously Valerie Cardenas and Karina Trapaco, as I mentioned at the front, are my main co-workers. A lot of this data is from huge NIH imaging studies. In particular, the PIs of these are Mike Weiner, Dean Mayhoff, and also Norbert Schuff, who's an MR physicist. They work at the MR unit at the VA hospital in San Francisco. Bruce Miller, Harry Rosen are great neurologists who work at the Memory Aging Clinic at UCSF, and they're particularly interested in FTLD and AD. Robert Miller, also at UCSF, works in ALS. He provided the ALS data. A lot of the Alzheimer's and vascular dementia data comes from grants with Helena Chewy, Joel Kramer, and Bill Jagast. A lot of my funding comes from the Whitaker and also NIH grants, and some of these are related to the data acquisition, and some of them are processing. And that's it. Thank you.